This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even if you're not an investor, you may have money in the stock market through your retirement account. And if you think the market is hard to decipher, it may be even harder than you think. Computer code is now responsible for much of the activity on Wall Street. The image of smart analysts studying annual reports and the stock exchange floor crowded with men yelling out trades is becoming outdated. Much of the analysis and trading is now done by computers programmed with lines of code called algorithms. With these computers, high-frequency traders, also known as flash traders, can buy and sell thousands of shares a second. My guest, Felix Salmon, says this has created a new market, volatile, unpredictable, and impossible for humans to comprehend. Salmon's article, Algorithms Take Control of Wall Street, is published in the January issue of Wired magazine. Salmon writes about the financial world for Reuters.com and the Columbia Journalism Review website. Last year, he won the Excellence in Statistical Reporting Award from the American Statistical Association. Felix Salmon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
The way the stock market used to work, I'm told, is that the individual investor or the brilliant investor at the mutual fund studied companies' fundamentals and based on that made investing decisions. Now that Wall Street is ruled by algorithms, the computers are using different information and a different kind of logic than the individual investor studying the health of an individual company would. So what is in these what are the computers looking for with these algorithms? What kind of information is feeding them that's different from, say, if you were making an investment, what you would be looking at?
Well, let's not romanticize the past too much here, because in the past, the vast majority of investors have always been speculators of some description. They buy stocks because they think they're going up, or they sell stocks because they think they're going down, and they try and make profits. And there are always traders in the middle of this, people who exist not to hold stocks as long-term investments, but just to buy and sell in the markets every day and try and make a small profit every day, and they sell stocks for slightly higher prices than they're selling them for, and that's where their profits come from. And now what's happened is that those traders in the middle of the market have all pretty much been replaced by machines, and that a lot of the fundamental investors, the mutual funds and so forth, who weren't only, by the way, looking at fundamentals, a lot of them were love what they called technical analysis, where they look at lines on charts and extrapolate them and decide that now's a good time to buy or sell. A lot of that activity has now been automated as well. So you get investors, the investment decisions being made by machines, and also the trading decisions being made by machines. And obviously, machines are going to use more information more quickly than any human ever could. So we don't know exactly what information is really moving the market anymore. But then again, we never really did.
So just so I understand this better, it seems like there are different investment companies and mutual funds that have their own algorithms, their own set of computational analysis. And these are like proprietary codes that you don't want anybody else to know about, because it's like this is your secret formula to trading and understanding the market. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. You have hedge funds, virtually all hedge funds, and lots of Wall Street banks have these black boxes with a lot of code that they spent a lot of time developing. And it's almost impossible to copyright that code or to patent that code or to make it public in any way, because the minute it becomes public, everyone else is going to copy it. So they are very jealously secretive about their code, and they try and use it to make money in ways that no one else has thought of.
So what are the different kinds of trades? What are some of the different kinds of actions that the computers now, through these complicated algorithms, are making decisions about? Because it's not just what to buy and sell, right?
Exactly. I mean, ultimately, every trade that they make is either a buy or a sell. That's the only thing you can do in the market. But what they're doing is they're looking at a huge number of data sets. They're looking at everything from weather forecasts to Twitter streams to whole areas of data streams which you and I can probably never even think of. And they're putting them all together and they're analyzing them. And what they're doing is they're learning from them in these sort of algorithmic, almost artificial intelligence type ways. They're looking at one set of data or a whole big stream of data from many, many different sources, a fire hose, really, which no human could ever get their head around. They're looking at economic indicators. They're looking at fundamental indicators. They're looking at technical indicators, anything you can imagine. And then they're looking to see what happens in the markets as all of this data comes through, and they're trying to find patterns there. And then what they are ultimately looking for is a kind of if-then algorithm, I suppose you could call it. They can say, if this kind of thing happens in the data stream, then what you're likely to see is that the stocks go up or stocks go down. And then they use those movements and those predictions to make bets and to hopefully make money. But what we're seeing here is so complex, and a lot of the time the movements are so tiny, they can make money because it costs so little money to trade in the market these days. They can make money just if a stock moves a few cents. You don't need to predict a big move in the stock market. You can make money off such tiny moves that a lot of what they do just simply is incomprehensible to human minds. In the article in Wired magazine, we talk about this company over in Berkeley, California, called Voleon. They don't really know what they're trading on. They just set their computers loose on a set of data and say, find a signal in all of this noise and then trade on it. And somehow it, you know, seems to work.
And through this method, you can make a lot of money if a stock just moves a few cents because you're buying so many shares. Is that it?
Because you're buying so many shares and because you're making so many trades, you can make thousands of trades a second. You can make these bets not just once or twice a day as people used to do, but once or twice a millisecond. And when you're trading that frequently, if you're only making a cent each time, it still adds up very quickly.
Are there algorithms now created to spy on other algorithms, to crack the codes of other algorithms so that one company will know, we know one investment company will know what the other investment companies are up to and try to outsmart them?
Exactly. That's known as predatory trading, and it's a very large business. And one of the things they do is they try and trick other algorithms to think that they're, say, buying rather than selling, so that the other algorithms will try and come in and raise the price. It gets very complicated. It's a spy versus spy thing. One of the people quoted in the article calls it a bit like the hunt for Red October. It's like submarine warfare where you're pinging out into the dark trying to find out where the other trades are, what the other algorithms are, what they're doing. And they're trying to cloak themselves and discover each other and basically try and get one up on each other. It's a very, very complex, very, very high-speed, incredibly high-stakes game, and people can make millions at it if they're good at it.
So we've been talking about high-frequency trading and how algorithms are being used in that. Let's talk about flash trading. Would you describe what flash trading is?
In the stock market is a little bit like journalism in a way. You want to be faster than anyone, smarter and smarter than anyone faster. And so one of the ways that firms compete in the stock market is they try just simply to compete on speed. They want to be able to make trades a fraction of a millisecond faster than anybody else. And so what they do is they take their computers and they literally place them right in the same room as the stock exchange, in the same racks as the stock exchange's computers, so that when they place an order and it moves at the speed of light down a wire, that wire is shorter than some other wire which might have to be a couple of miles long. It's you wind up having programs written specifically for the architecture of certain computer chips, and you get computer chip employees, company employees, being acting as consultants for quants and stuff, trying to explain how these computer programs can be written so that the computer chip can make its decision just a tiny fraction of a millisecond faster than the other guy. And so at this point, you're not trying to crunch enormous amounts of information and make big trades which might last for weeks or months. Instead, you're just trying to get into the market and do what traders have always done. Human traders have always tried to be fast. They've always been trading back and forth very, very quickly. But these machines have moved that by orders of magnitude, many, many orders of magnitude. And you can get these trades just happening super, super fast, buying and selling stocks. They don't really know where the stock is moving or care. They just want to be in there right in the middle of the market, making these tiny little spreads on where the stocks are trading.
So let me ask you, if computers are basically running a lot of the market now, making the decisions, what is happening to the people who used to make the decisions?
There are many fewer traders on the floors of stock exchanges than there used to be. You know, the old visions of the men in bright jackets all screaming at each other. That doesn't really happen anymore. It all happens over computers these days. And in general, what you have is more hedge funds, fewer enormous brokerages and Wall Street shops trying to just stay on top of the mechanics of making trades and of clearing trades and of buying and selling stocks, because all of that's become computerized. It's, you know, a move. Wall Street becomes a slightly different business, and, you know, you get more computer wonks and fewer old school traders and screamers and shouters. It's the evolution of the market.
So let's look a little more closely at the flash crash from last May. Can you explain how this algorithmic approach to investing played a part in the market dropping 573 points in 5 minutes?
What happened is there was one relatively obscure mutual fund company which decided that it wanted to hedge its positions in the market. It owned a lot of stocks, and it wanted to protect against the eventuality that the stock market would fall. And so one of the ways that you do that is you sell stock market futures. It's a natural hedge in the futures market. And they made a relatively large trade in the futures market, and they used an algorithm to make that trade, like everyone always does these days. And when you use an algorithm, you can set a whole bunch of different parameters, including how quickly you want that trade made. So if I'm selling 1 million shares of IBM, I might go up to my, you know, Wall Street bank and say, listen, use your algorithm to sell these shares and make sure that you do it in the next day. What this guy did was he used his algorithm. He said, sell these futures and make sure you do it in the next 20 minutes. And that's a very short amount of time to do a trade that big. And so the fact that such a large trade went through the market so quickly is that fact moved the market, and it sent the stock market futures down substantially. And that kind of move gets picked up on by all of the other computers. They see this sudden unexplained drop in the market, and they see the little uptick in volume, and they say, ooh, we've got the signs of a panic here. We've got the signs of what could be a big drop. They're looking at all manner of other technical indicators as well, but they all seem to come to the same decision, that what they should do is either get out of the market completely or start selling. And there was almost no one in the market buying. And in that situation, you can get this massive plunge because you have pretty much the normal amount of sellers. Most people just stepped back and said, we don't want any part of this market. But you have no buyers at all. And when you have no buyers, the price of the market can just drop precipitously. And that's exactly what happened. So it's hard to protect against. We have no real mechanism to be able to stop this from happening. And what we do have is very blunt instruments about just saying, well, every single stock market in the entire country should simply close down when the market or a single stock has moved more than 5% or 10%, these things called circuit breakers. They're very blunt instruments and they don't work particularly well, but for the time being, they're all that we have.
Let's get back to the flash crash of last May, where the stock market lost 573 points. I guess it was the Dow Jones lost 573 points in 5 minutes. And one North Carolina utility company lost 90% of its share price in less than 5 minutes. Apple share dropped nearly 4% in 30 seconds. And those two trades were canceled because it was
Actually, in the flash crash, it was interesting. While everything else was crashing, there was a trade of Apple at $100,000 a share.
Wow. Okay. So crazy, right? That just like totally out of proportion. And that was canceled, right?
Yes.
So is it unusual to have a do-over in the stock market like that?
Yes, it is. And a lot of people are quite unhappy about that. But it makes sense. When you get something which is so clearly nonsensical and where the stock market just broke, then you shouldn't be able to profit off someone else's misfortune. For instance, let's say that you, Terry Gross, have a margin account at a stock brokerage. And I would recommend that you don't because it's a great way of losing money. But you might have a stop loss order in there. You might say, I have a bunch of shares of IBM, and if they fall below a certain price, then just sell them because at that point something bad is going on and I don't want to lose too much money. And so you say, okay, so if it falls below $30 a share, then I want to sell. But in something like the flash crash, that stock might go straight from $35 a share to $1 a share with nothing in between. And then your market order to sell when it drops below $30 a share, you suddenly only get $1 a share. And you thought you were protecting yourself. You thought that you would just sell at 30 and protect yourself from any further losses. But in fact, what you wound up doing is making all of those losses by selling at $1 a share instead of doing nothing and waiting for it to come back. And so, as it did in a matter of a few minutes. So what the stock market did when it canceled all of those trades is basically protect people like that who'd put in these orders and who would otherwise have made enormous losses.
So are there rules in effect for when to do a do-over? I mean, now that all these algorithms, competing algorithms, are ruling the market, and it's hard for any human to make sense of what's happening, and there's all these like positive and negative feedback loops happening. Who says when there's a do-over and when there's not, and when you're protected from kind of nonsensical behavior caused by these algorithms, and when you're not protected?
In the big picture, we're not protected, and it would be foolish for anyone to expect to be protected. There are no rules saying that there has to be a do-over if certain actions happen. It's entirely up to the discretion of the exchanges and the regulators. And sometimes they will step in and say, you know what, that was a bad trade, undo that trade, it never happened. At other times they won't, and they'll let that trade stay. And you can't – it's fundamentally unpredictable, and it's not something which people should really take any solace in. So it's a good idea, as I say, not to play in the market. This is one of the good reasons why individual investors should probably avoid having these margin accounts and putting in these trades, because if something crazy does happen in the market, they might wind up making some insane trade inadvertently, and they might not have that trade rescinded. It's a very dangerous place, or it can be.
When you look at the new shape of Wall Street now, what are some of the warning signs that you see, some of the dangers?
The main danger about algorithmic trading is that we simply don't understand it. We don't understand how the stock market works, or to be precise, how the stock markets work, because there's over a dozen of these things now. We don't understand the feedback loops between them. We don't understand what causes individual stocks or entire market indices to move. We have an incredibly complex system with only the most rudimentary controls. And we got a hint of what could happen last May during the flash crash. But we have no idea what other things might happen. We don't have any ability to – we don't have a sort of flight simulator for stock markets where we can run a whole bunch of possible scenarios and see how the stock markets might react. We really have no idea how these markets work, or how these complex systems work, or how they might just explode one day in a very unpredictable manner. And so the big problem here is uncertainty. there's lots of what's known as tail risk. Most of the time, it works great. Most of the time, computerized trading and algorithmic trading makes stock markets more efficient, and it makes it easier and cheaper for investors, both large and small, to trade. And it's a good thing for everybody. But every so often, things can go horribly wrong, and we don't know when, and we don't know how, and we don't know what the consequences might be. And that huge uncertainty is, I think, the biggest danger in the markets right now.
Felix Salmon, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Felix Salmon's article, Algorithms Take Control of Wall Street, is published in the January edition of Wired magazine. He writes about the financial world for Reuters.com. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to listen back to an interview with the jazz and pop singer Margaret Whiting. She died Monday at the age of 86. She's best known for her recordings from the 40s and 50s of songs like Moonlight in Vermont, It Might as Well Be Spring, and That Old Black Magic. In 2009, her recording of Time After Time was used over the closed credits in the movie Julie and Julia. Whiting's extended family wrote many of the songs in her repertoire. Her father, Richard Whiting, composed My Ideal, Too Marvelous for Words, She's Funny That Way, and On the Good Ship Lollipop. Composer Jerome Kern was Uncle Jerry to her. Lyricist Johnny Mercer was like a surrogate father after her father died. Margaret Whiting made her first records for Mercer's Capitol label, and she was a teenager in the 1940s. I spoke with her in 1987, after the publication of her memoir, It Might as Well Be Spring. In it, she also wrote about her relationship with Jack Wrangler, which had raised a lot of eyebrows. Wrangler was a former porn star who made his name in gay films. He was more than 20 years her junior. They were married from 1994 until his death in 2009. Let's start with a 1977 recording of a song co-written by her father and Johnny Mercer.
I search for phrases to sing your praises, but there aren't any magic adjectives to tell you all you are. You're just too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they're just not swell enough. You're much too much, and just too very, very to ever be Webster's Dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
Margaret Whiting, I bet you remember when your father wrote that song.
Well, kind of, because I was quite young when he wrote it. He wrote it with Johnny Mercer, and it was for Ruby Keeler, in a picture called Ready, Willing, and Able. It had to be before 1938. And I'm not sure the year, but I was still young. But I remember going into my father's studio every day when I came home from school or when my mother would allow me in, and he would always play what he'd written that day. So I remember hearing it and liking it, and I still do.
Did you assume that all girls had fathers who stayed at the piano most of the day writing songs?
Yes, because my girlfriend was Harry Warren's daughter, and she and I went to school together, and what she had, I had. In other words, one day at my house, I might have Jerome Kern, Uncle Jerry, or I might have Benny Goodman, who my father did a picture for, or at Harry Warren's, we might have Tommy Dorsey, or we might have Jimmy Dorsey, or we might have Glenn Miller. We might have young Frank Sinatra, Jack Leonard. So I thought everybody, you know, had the same kind of bringing up. I went to school with William Powell's son and Victor McLaughlin's son and all kinds of people like that, Fanny Bryce's daughter and son. So I just thought, well, everybody had a famous parent, and we didn't even think of them as famous. oh, daddy did this, and my daddy painted that, and my father directed this, or my mother was in this picture. And we were all very calm and cool about it, you know, because we were told not to make a lot of it. But everybody, as I write in my book, I said, I grew up in a factory town because the studios were like factories. I mean, you went to school. If you were in a motion picture, you'd go to the studio at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, makeup, hair, whatever else you did in the picture. The producers would come in early to see a scene. The directors would come in, of course, early. And it was like a factory. And it's not like that anymore. I mean, it's serious and work, but the whole thing of Hollywood has changed.
Well, you started recording songs when you were a teenager.
Oh, yes.
And they were songs whose lyrics were pretty sophisticated and lyrics about love, like That Old Black Magic. Were you able to comprehend what it was you were singing about as a teenager?
Not really. But I was lucky enough, you know, to have Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer as the composer of that tell me how to do it. Rhythmically, Harold Arlen wrote such great music. I mean, he was really into blues. He was he and Gershwin were the two composers that wrote that kind of music. And
so what would he tell you?
Well,
when you were
he would tell me to emphasize certain notes and emphasize certain words and emphasize certain beats. Like he said, that old black magic has me in its spell. He said, do it like that. Don't go, that old black magic. Don't make it legato. Phrase it, that old black magic has me in its spell. And Johnny would say, use the word black and emphasize it. That old black magic. So those men just, it's like being in a bind or being in a place where the walls closed in and there was nowhere to go but the right way because they were there teaching me.
That must have just been great.
Oh, it was marvelous. And to have all those kind of songwriters around. Johnny and Frank Lesser taught me the importance of reading a lyric. Johnny Mercer often said to me, Margaret, it's like a one-act play, each song. Now, if it's a rhythm song, then you have fun with it. And you find the words to really emphasize the important words, and you do it rhythmically, and you have fun. But on a ballad, if it's a torch song or if it's a story that you want to tell, then you've got to be very careful, and you've got to find the climax, where it's going, and do it like a play.
I want to play a recent recording of a song that was your first hit, your father's song, My Ideal. You have known the song and have been singing the song for
many years.
What goes through your mind when you sing it now?
Well, it's one of my favorite songs, and it was my father's favorite song. He would play this before he'd start to write something else. He adored this song, and he'd always say, oh, God, I hope I can write another one like it. And there's something kind of special about it. It was my beginning. So I try to make it new and fresh, as if I'm singing it for the first time, because audiences do not know me, some of them. Audiences do not know the song. But more important, really, is that many people do know, and that's one of their memories of me. So I always have to sing it as well, or if not better than any of the other songs, because that's a memory song to them. And they love the fact my father wrote it and I sang it. So I try to think of, it could be Jack, whom you know that we'll talk about, that I go with now. It could be a love when I was a kid, but it's an image of someone that could be my ideal. And will I recognize him? In other words, again, reading the lyric and getting that innocent, honest, first time I ever sang it feeling.
Let's listen to my guest, Margaret Whiting, singing a song written by her father, Richard Whiting. This is My Ideal.
Long ago, my heart and mind got together and designed a wonderful boy for me. Oh, what a fantasy. Though the idol of my heart can't be ordered a la carte, I wonder if he will be fantasy. Will I ever find the boy on my mind? One who is my ideal. Maybe he's a dream, and yet he may be just around the corner waiting for me. Will I recognize that light in his eyes that no other eyes reveal? Or will I pass him by and never even know that he was my ideal? Will I recognize that light in his eyes that no other eyes? I'll trust in fate, and so I wait for my ideal, for my ideal.
I think so many of us grow up with our expectations about what love will be like, with those expectations shaped by the pop songs that we listen to.
And the books we read.
And the books
and
we read.
And the
movies
we see. And the shows we see. And the Valentines we send.
But we sing along with the pop songs. And,
oh, certainly.
And the lyrics just really become part of our visions. Now, you sang those pop songs professionally when you were young. You sang those pop songs before you really knew firsthand.
Absolutely.
About love. Did they shape your idea of what love and romance was supposed to be like?
Well, I think that we're all born here with a certain group of rules or a foundation where we would go to school, we would grow up, we would find our first crush in school probably, and it probably wouldn't work out, and eventually we would meet somebody and we would get married and we would have children and it would last forever. And thus is not the case, as most of us find out.
You're pretty frank in your book, and you even write about losing your virginity and how you almost wanted to just get it done with because you'd heard it wasn't so interesting the first time around.
Well, that's right. So that's absolutely true. And you're the first person that's brought that up, but it just was something that I'd heard, you know, That's something to get over with and get on with living. I'm not so sure today, if I knew today what I know at that age, I wouldn't have done it that way.
But I almost had the feeling reading your book that you were doing it to get more of a sense of what the songs were like that you were singing.
I wanted to know what love was and sex was and all these words that people were throwing around and living that I wasn't.
All the double entendres in the songs.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's interesting, but it was very sophisticated out in Hollywood, too. And everybody, the group that you live with out there, unlike, let's face it, Hollywood is one place. Hollywood has many people working in many different businesses, bankers, doctors, lawyers, everything. And Los Angeles is a great big city. But in my group, I was raised with people in show business. And it was a certain way of living, and it was much more sophisticated because we were doing make-believe, we were doing pictures, we were doing television, we were doing all these things, and it was what everybody dreamed about. I mean, I've had kids come to me and say, Oh, you came from Hollywood. Is Hollywood Boulevard golden?
So tell me, did having sex change your interpretation of songs?
I think so. I think I said, oh, that's what it's all about.
You came of age professionally during World War II.
Yes, absolutely.
And even, I think, toured a few times with Bob Hope.
Oh, I toured with him. I was with him for 7 years. So I toured a lot of places with Bob Hope.
What did you learn from those tours, both about show business and about things like timing?
Oh, everything. When you work with someone like Eddie Cantor, and I was fortunate enough to work with Eddie and Jack Carson, and then Hope, if you start to move on a line, he grabs you. He says, never move on a line because the audience watches the movement.
You mean like on a punchline?
Yes. Well, or anything. If you're gonna go back and forth, and if I start moving, whatever he's going to say, they're going to pay attention to me. They're not going to hear the punchline. And timing is such an important thing. I learned it from Red Skelton. Learned it from all these marvelous geniuses, Jack Benny, that I worked with.
Barry Manilow met you, and this is when he was the music director for Bette Midler, and when she was playing the Baths in New York, and he took you to see her. He liked your singing, and you were interested in his songs, and he took you to see her at the Baths?
Yeah, I knew him before that. And one night he said, it's my birthday, and I'd like to go hear Carole King, and we did. Then he said, I've got my band, and we're going to play for a girl. I'd met Bette before. So we went up to the Baths, which was just where men went, and they were all dressed in towels, and I was put behind a rope, and Bette Midler came out, great as she is, and just rocked the place, and then she got me up to sing Moonlight in Vermont, and they loved it. So on the way home, I said, Barry, I got to tell you something. Don't lose this woman. She's brilliant, and you're a terrific combination.
We're listening back to a 1987 interview with singer Margaret Whiting. She died Monday at the age of 86. Here's her 1945 recording of Moonlight in Vermont.
Pennies in a stream, falling leaves, a sycamore, moonlight. Trails on a mountainside, snow light in Vermont, telegraph cables they sing down the highway and travel each bend in the road. People who romantic setting are so hypnotized by the lovely evening summer breeze, warbling of a meadowlark, moonlight in Vermont.
Your life has been changed in the last few years with your relationship with Jack Wrangler, and I'd love to hear the story of how you met him. And
well, I went into a restaurant one night, and there's a wonderful place in New York. There was a wonderful place where everybody would go in show business and everybody else, called Backstage. And there was a piano player there, and we would be introduced by the owner, Ted Hook. And he had introduced this charming gentleman that I was looking at across a table. But I thought I knew him. And they'd said his name was Jack Wrangler, and he was doing such and such a picture. I wasn't paying much attention. Then they introduced me, and I got up and took a bow, and then Jack came over to the table. He said, I've loved your singing, and I'm an admirer, and I think you're terrific. So I said, I knew him. Now, I had met him as Jack Stillman, who was a director in Chicago and doing all the top shows there. But he had gone to a gym, and his body had changed, and he's changed his hairstyle. So I said, I didn't recognize him. I said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm doing my act. So I said, good, I'd love to see it. He said, well, you can come next Wednesday night. I'll have my stage manager leave tickets. So that was that, and he left. And Ted Hook came over to me and said, you said you were going to see his act? I said, yes. He said, do you know what he does? I said, no. He said, well, he makes porn pictures. I said, you're kidding. He's so charming. He says, he is charming. I said, Ted, I don't understand. A week ago, he introduced me to Jamie Gillis, and he's in porn pictures. I said, a few weeks before, you introduced me to Harry Reams. What is this? He said, well, they're all great guys, and they all come to the restaurant. So anyway, it was too late. I thought about it, and so a girlfriend of mine and Ted Hook and somebody else went with me. We went to the theater. Jack couldn't have been nicer. He was very charming. He got up. He talked about how he got into porn pictures and some of the funny things that had happened, and he introduced me, and I got up and took a bow, and then he came to out front and said, I'd love to see you again. So we made a date for brunch, and we sat at my house for a while and went downstairs to brunch, and I found out that he had the same kind of background I did. He came from Beverly Hills. He had been a kid star. He'd won an Emmy for Faith of Our Children, and he'd been directing, and then suddenly, I don't know, he wanted to get out of that. He wanted to go back to Hollywood and act, and he couldn't get a job. He tried. So he got a job in a play, and I guess he took his shirt off, and then he took his pants off. He wasn't nude, but somebody came to him and said, oh, we want to do another play. And some film man saw him and said, would you do this part in this picture? And he got into it, and that's how he got into it.
He made his reputation in gay porn films
first, and then he went into heterosexual films.
It must have been seemed a potentially very treacherous kind of relationship to get involved in.
Yes, and I had no intention of getting involved. But we had the same kind of background. We went to the same schools years apart, went to the same dancing schools. And then you've met Jack, and you know the kind of person he is. He's a very fine person. And I realized that he'd gotten into this somehow, and he didn't know how to get out. But then I talked to Jack, and I said, look, you're a very fine director, and you're a good actor. You've got such a potential. You should come to New York, where they're far more forgiving and understanding. And he's done several, when I say straight plays, I mean, they have nothing to do with X-rated things at all. And he's just written a very funny, charming play. And it's wonderful. It's called I Love You, Jimmy Valentine. And all of this is behind him.
There's a 20-year age gap between you. You're 20 years older than he is. And I wonder if being in a relationship like that has made you feel older or younger.
It's made me feel just as I always feel. I'm Margaret Whiting. Age has never meant an important thing to me because I enjoy good health. I have a wonderful zest for life. And Jack and I have a terrific time. We work together personally in the act. He'll do my act, he'll direct my act or find me material. And we've never even worried about the age.
There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about singing. You grew up the daughter of one of the great American composers, Richard Whiting. Your extended family were some of the greatest composers, Jerome Kern and Johnny Mercer. Did you grow up thinking that to sing a song you really had to stick to the composer's intention, stick to what was on the page, but the lyric and the music? Because a lot of singers will stray from that and will reinterpret a song.
Well, I reinterpret now. But I certainly did stick to what they said because my father said to me, look, sing the songs the way we wrote them. Took us a long time. That's our craft. We're professional. And that stuck with me. And, of course, Johnny and Harold and everybody said, you know, sing them the way we wrote them or the way we sing them as we teach them to you. But recently I've had more of a jazz sound and gone in a little bit different direction, as has Rosemary Clooney. But I think we're still singing them traditionally, but in a different way. I mean, I'm not going to louse up a lyric because I adore those lyrics. And I'm certainly not going to, I mean, bend a note here and there, but I'm going to give it a different conception, but within the architecture of the song, the foundation of the song, because that's the way I was taught. But stylists are the people that take a song the way I sing it and then do it completely differently, and bravo for them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing so much about your life with us.
Well,
thank
I had
you
a ball.
Being here.
I really had a ball. I enjoyed it.
Margaret Whiting, recorded in 1987. She died Monday at the age of 86. We'll close with her 1949 recording with Johnny Mercer of Baby It's Cold Outside. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
I really can't
but
stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go
but
away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you'd
so
drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hands. They're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful,
worry.
What's your hurry?
And father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so
roar.
Really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't
well,
hurry.
Well, maybe just a half a drink
put
more.
Put some records on while I
the neighbors
pour.
Might think.
Maybe it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this
no
drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew
your
how
eyes are like starlight
to
now.
Break the spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks swell.
I ought to say no, no,
mind
no,
if
sir.
I'm moving
at
closer.
Least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my
I
pride?
I really can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Baby, but it's cold outside.